It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The internet, video games, food, sex, gambling, all of these things can be fun and make us feel good, but for some people, they also have the potential to become addictive. Behavioral addictions are not all recognized as equally legitimate, especially compared to substance use disorders. Our next guest will break down similarities and differences between behavioral addictions and substance-related addictions, and how to know if a behavior is becoming an addiction, and how to get help if you need it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced behavioral addiction? How did it or how does it affect your life? Have you sought and have you found treatment? Is this something that's been an issue in your family? Join in with your experiences or your questions on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Stephanie Steinman is a clinical psychologist with a doctoral degree in clinical psychiatry, psychology, at UW Health and an assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW Madison. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob. I'm so glad to talk about this very important topic.
How do we define behavioral addiction in the first place?
Yeah, so this is really the difficulty. The guide that psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists use doesn't even have behavioral addictions other than gambling disorder yet included. So it's nothing that we can formally diagnose. However, there are proposed criteria being put forth that are actually very similar to what we're seeing with substance use disorders. So people having a tolerance, having to engage in more and more of the behavior in order to feel the effects, even withdrawal symptoms from things like behavioral disorders, feeling more irritated, difficulty with sleeping when you're not able to engage in those behaviors, and it just having consequences on you both personally and professionally.
What are some of the most common types of behavior that people have these, whether or not we call them addictions, these addiction-like behaviors associated with?
Yeah, so I am definitely seeing more and more video game addictions. And so parents being concerned as their teenagers, particularly when they go to college, these young adults engaging in this behavior to the expense of their studies. And then just the amount of time I think that all of us spent on the internet during COVID, starting to question how much of this is a problem and how much is that taking over my life day to day.
These are a lot of these are common behaviors we're talking about, right? Using the internet or playing video games, or it might be shopping or food, or the list goes on and on. How do we start to see if our regular everyday behavior is becoming something different? It's becoming a mental health concern.
Such a great question. And I think it's really looking at the impairment that that is causing. And so while a lot of us have probably stayed up later in the night that we meant to doom scrolling, when it turns into more and more of a difficult behavior that's having consequences on our daily functioning, this is when it might be a time to take a look at it. And if the person tries to set limits and is really failing at being able to do so, that might be a time to seek additional support and help around it.
Speaking of help and support, what kind of treatments are out there for people with a behavioral addiction?
Yeah, so again, with the difficulty of even getting the diagnosis, mm-hmm. like I had talked about in the beginning, it can be difficult to have a treatment provider who specializes in these things. And so oftentimes treatment has to start with taking a look at maybe anxiety or depression that's going on as well. Or there is a diagnosis called impulse control disorder that can kind of encompass some of these behaviors that are happening. And so with treatment then, that's often going to look very similar to treatment for substance use disorders. So a person who already has some specialty in addiction might be an ideal person to seek help from. And the additional plug that I am going to put out there is looking into some self-compassion groups in your area or even online. Oftentimes, the root of these addictions happening is because of shame that hasn't been addressed. And so when you feel pretty terrible about yourself, you're looking for ways to help you feel better. And when we find those, it can be really easy to get caught up in them and get distracted and not be feeling those deep-rooted feelings. And so then that addiction can form.
Now, if someone knows someone with an addiction of any kind, substance, behavior, whatever, it can be easy to look in from the outside and think, buck up, a little willpower, you can control this, whatever. It's not, as in my limited understanding, it's just not that simple, is it?
Very much so. And so, again, if you think of someone stepping in and telling you not to do something, how well that goes over. Imagine something that this person is actually getting a lot of enjoyment out of, despite the consequences. And so we're learning more and more about willpower and it just not being very applicable to a case where it has changed the wiring of a person's brain. The reward pathways are now different for this person when they're engaging in that behavior. And so it's not as simple as just say no. We learned that campaign did not work with substance use disorders. It doesn't work very well with behavioral addictions as well. And so it's really having the willingness to come to the person and have these conversations and talk with the person and try to understand where they're coming from and come with that with love and kindness.
Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us from UW Health talking about behavioral addictions, regular behaviors in some cases that get out of hand, cause negative impact in our lives, what we can do about them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have a question for a guest or maybe an experience to share. Now, Stephanie, some of these things might be easier to avoid. A gambling problem, there are ways to maybe stay away from gambling environments. That's harder these days with the internet. For something like food or shopping, right? These are things we need to do every day. Does that raise the problem when you're regularly confronted with that thing you have that behavioral addiction to?
Very much so. And so this is what my patients are often talking about. With things like alcohol and other drugs, there are some pretty clear limits that can be set with that, although I would say in Wisconsin that's a little bit harder than some other states I've lived in. And like you were saying, with food, even with the internet, of talking with people, of this is something that they're going to have to use for school or work every day. There's not going to be that abstinence-only model that you can take with the treatment. And so it's really working with them on how they can figure out their triggers and limits that they can still set around it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So when I was working on my undergrad in history and political science, I minored in psychology. And one of the questions that I had was, why hadn't something like alcoholism died out in the past? And I came across some research which said that by people being alcoholics in the past, it actually made the society at whole sometimes more ready for problems that were coming towards them, because when there was some sort of loud noise or an explosion or some sort of other event, people who had the addiction tendency would be the ones who would run towards it to find out what it was, while people who did not have that same addiction would then go back and warn the village. And so it actually provided an advanced warning, in a sense, which helped all people survive.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Interesting, Stephanie. I don't know if you want to get into the evolutionary history, I guess, behind addiction, but in the present day, is there such a thing as a more addiction-prone person?
Yes. Yeah, so we do know that genetics play a role, and the research is already starting to merge about behavioral addictions as well, that there is a genetic component to it. I can't speak very much on evolutionary psychology. Research is still being done on that, but fascinating to look at. And again, really important, I think, for family members to be educated, because so many times addiction is not discussed. And then unfortunately, it can continue because people are just not aware that they are at a much higher risk of experiencing an addictive disorder.
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned just now behavioral addiction, something we don't necessarily talk about. I think we're just starting to get to a point where people are more willing to talk about substance abuse disorders, other mental health concerns. Are you hopeful that we're going to be more open and willing to talk about these behavioral addictions that many of us might find personally embarrassing at the very least?
Very much so, through exactly programs like this, which is why I'm so glad to be here and talking about it today. And as many problems as people might have with TikTok, I think it has been a great resource for actually reducing stigma and discrimination around mental health and addiction disorders.
Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us. We're talking about behavioral addictions, how they might be similar or different to other types of addiction, what they look like, how to get help. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen certain behavioral addictions become more prevalent or more recognized over the years? Have you seen things like video games or the internet becoming more addictive to you or someone in your family? If you are dealing with this yourself or with a family member and you're willing to share your story, we'd love to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman from UW Health, assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison, talking about behavioral addictions, what they are, how they're diagnosed and treated. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried that you or a loved one might be struggling with some kind of behavioral addiction? Is this something you've experienced in your life that you're comfortable sharing with us? We'd appreciate it if so. Do you have questions about diagnosis, treatment, what it looks like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jay joins us now in Wisconsin Rapids. Jay, hello.
Yeah, howdy.
What did you want to bring up, Jay?
Well, I was wondering, I had a question for the psychologist. People who are engaging in addictive behaviors and these patterns of behavior, has the research found that they're doing this because they need further pleasure through the behavior, or are they using these addictive behaviors to run away from and mask painful realities within their life? It's running towards or running away from, I guess, is the basis of the question.
Interesting question, Jay. Stephanie, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. And it's actually most likely a combination is what we're seeing. And so in the beginning, that oftentimes something has happened. If trauma is a part of it, they're definitely at higher risk for developing an addiction. And then what happens once they start to engage in that behavior over and over, it actually changes their reward pleasure. And so needing to get that hit more and more often in order to feel good. So we have this combination of a first running away and then really running toward.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. What does it take for someone to recognize that they have a behavioral addiction? I'm imagining for many people it might develop very slowly, maybe so slowly that they don't notice that they've gotten there.
Yeah, and so this is where the friends and the family members are often the first ones to speak up to them, even before the person themselves is recognizing the impact that it's having on others around them, which again is why I think it's so important as friends and family members to know this is definitely something to talk about. It's just in a way to come at it with compassion with for the person, so that then the person feels more comfortable of starting to address the problem within themselves.
I've had a lot of conversations with experts on various elements of mental health who talk about the value of peer support. And you touched on this earlier, talking about, you know, reaching out if you can't find a treatment, there might be peer support. Can you talk more about what kind of things might work? What kind of communities are out there that you see as at least potentially helpful?
Yeah, and so again, because this isn't even fully recognized yet, there's definitely more limited peer support for the behavioral addictions than the substance addictions. Although Sex Addicts Anonymous is available for people. And then NAMI is a fantastic organization. I'm actually on the board of directors for it. But for people with mental health issues themselves, but also for friends and family members, that those support groups are available. And then like I said earlier, I really want to emphasize looking for some kind of self-compassion group. Being able to develop that for the self and others can be really life-changing for people.
I want to talk more about that concept of self-compassion, because as I understand it, there can be kind of a shame cycle. Oh, I know I have a problem with fill in the blank there. I feel bad that I have this problem, but the thing that I'd reach for to deal with that shame is more of that problem. Is that a self-perpetuating cycle?
Very much so. And so this is where we really need to figure out how to interrupt it in a different way than our brain is kind of naturally attuned to, which is to come in with that judgment of, oh, this is bad or wrong. I shouldn't be doing that. And trying to use that as a motivator, unfortunately, just leads us back to the behavior that we're trying to stop in the beginning. And instead, if we can come in with kindness, understanding, and recognition of the common humanity that this is how it feels when a person is suffering, it really interrupts that shame cycle. And then they have a whole new pathway that they can open up within their brains in order to make some different choices.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mache is with us in Mount Pleasant. Mache, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you guys today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Well, like I was telling you, the person that I spoke to before, I came from Poland when I was 10, 11 years old with my mom and my sister. When I came here initially, obviously it was a financial situation where we struggled. And I can remember being in middle school, a young girl said to me, "Those are the three shirts that you're wearing all the time. Why don't you have any more clothes?" So see, that sort of stuck with me, and now I have shirts. My big thing is shirts. I have one closet full of shirts. I have another closet full of shirts. I've got a pole that I put down in the basement where I hang shirts up on. I go, I'm in Target or Kohl's, and I see something on the clearance rack for $2, and I just can't help but buy the shirt. I know, I can wear a different shirt every day for a year, and I wouldn't wear the same shirt twice. Mm.
Have you sought help? It sounds like you recognize this as not an ideal situation. Have you looked for ways to break that understandable shirt habit?
Oh, I have. And, I've broken it for periods of 2 months or so. Then, also, when the seasons change, I walk into the store and the stuff that's seasonal suddenly is on that clearance rack. And it's like, it's like a fish to a worm. I'm attracted to it in the worst way. Next thing you know, I'm walking out with 8, 9 shirts, which I really don't need. And it's less than $20. How can I not buy them? 9 shirts for less than $20 with tax.
Mache, thanks for the call. Good luck with dealing with it. Now, of course, Stephanie, I won't ask you to diagnose, treat a caller over the phone. But starting points, if a client comes to you and has a comparable problem, what kind of things do you start talking about?
Yeah, Mache, I just want to thank you so much for being vulnerable. So mm-hmm. That's actually the first piece that I talk about, is we have to name it to tame it. And so you're doing a great job of being able to see the recognition, and you're really highlighting exactly what Rob and I have been talking about, is you recognize where that shame developed of that girl mm-hmm. making that comment in elementary school. And so now what we have to do instead is start to feel it, to heal it. And so be able to go back to that kind of little kid within you and offer love and support in that moment, because he just wasn't understood that there wasn't very much money in the family. And again, trying to fill a hole with the shirts, it's never going to work, just like with any other behavioral disorder. We have to actually get to the root of the problem.
Mache, thanks again for that call. Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us from UW Health and UW Madison, looking at behavioral addictions. Something else that Mache said that struck me, Stephanie, is he's kicked it for a couple months at a time, a month here and there. Maybe this, for any kind of addiction, as I understand it, is fairly common. People might break it for a while or a year and bounce back. Challenging the idea that was a failure as opposed to a first step, maybe. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, so I run a group for kids, and they taught me FAIL stands for first attempt in learning. And so can we all start to reframe what FAIL means? and that we can keep learning from ourselves again and again. And it's actually so great for our brains to be able to recognize when there has been a lapse or a relapse and what we need to do different next time. And so getting away from this kind of black and white thinking of either I'm doing it right or wrong, of I'm being a human and I get to be here and keep trying over and over. What a fantastic thing to do for our brains to keep learning.
I wanted to ask, we've been mostly focusing on grownups here. How about that that parent or other caregiver who has a child or maybe a teen and they think they see some emerging behavioral addiction type behaviors? What do you say to them? How can that parent help out?
Yeah. And so the great thing about parents is you have more of that executive functioning and can step in and see these things a little bit earlier. And so ways that you can set boundaries of recognizing you get to have control over the Wi-Fi password and when that gets turned on and off, and be able to set those limits in place that the kid just isn't able to do yet for themselves. And that you can also hopefully then get them into treatment sooner rather than later because you have more of that responsibility over their day to day, and to make sure that they're getting to school and getting the good sleep that they need.
In just our last half a minute or so, are you hopeful that the psychiatric and psychological professions will take behavioral addictions more seriously in the near future?
Very much so. And there is already hope in the latest DSM. Internet video game addiction is being put under there for consideration, which means they're doing a lot more research on it. They just want to make sure that they're getting the criteria correct and that we'll be able to have most effective treatment in place once that does get moved into the DSM.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. I really enjoyed this conversation.
That's clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman with UW Health, assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about behavioral addictions, how to know if a behavior is becoming an addiction, and how to get help if you need it. If you want to know more about substance and mental health treatment programs in your area, you can call the free and confidential national helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-4357. You can also visit findtreatment.gov. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The holiday season is a time for eating with large family meals and plenty of cookies, pies, and treats. But for people with diabetes, it can be tough with temptation on every plate threatening to spike their blood sugar. Whether you have diabetes yourself or you're expecting a holiday guest with diabetes, many of us want to be considerate with our cooking this winter. Our next guest is here to help us tailor our menu and our recipes to help meet the needs of people with diabetes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your family? How does diabetes affect your holiday cooking? Have you found ways to navigate holidays in particular? Or do you have a question for some strategies about not just the recipes and ingredients, but timing and things like that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jessica Ball is a registered dietitian and the nutrition editor for Eating Well. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I could see people, Jessica, going to two extremes if they have diabetes. One, well, it's the holidays. I'm going to take a break from those rules. Or I have diabetes and I don't get to enjoy the holiday at all. You've been writing and thinking about this a lot lately. There are ways to navigate safely through the holidays, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, I'll just say the holidays should be about focusing on enjoying time with your family and your loved ones and being grateful for the year that's passed rather than stressing about every bite of food that you take. So that's the perspective that we share at Eating Well for people with any health conditions, including diabetes. But that should be priority one. That said, there are a few simple strategies that can go a long way in helping you feel your best and align with your goals over the holidays. And so one of my favorites and the simplest is called the plate method. So this is when you're like looking at your plate, right? And no matter where you are, aim to try and fill half of it with like non-starchy vegetables. So these are like your green beans, kale, peppers, onions, whatever you have at your gathering. Having a remaining quarter of the plate for higher protein, like satisfying foods like turkey or ham, and then leaving the last quarter for sources of carbohydrate. So this would be like whole grains or starchy vegetables like winter squash and potatoes. I would even put stuffing in this category because of the bread that it contains. So this method is super easy. It's super fast and it can be done anywhere without meticulous counting. So that's one of the main strategies. If you take one thing away from this, if you have diabetes, that should be it.
Now, before we even get to the meal, a lot of times these big gatherings will involve snacks. Now, with people with blood sugar problems, diabetes, and others, timing of food and what they eat can be super important. Can you talk about some snack strategies, especially, you know, the turkey's taken longer than we expect. We've all been at that gathering, I think. Can you talk about that pre-meal countdown and how people can deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I'll say that diabetes is such an individual disease, and everyone's blood sugar levels and their response to food can be really individual. So always check with your healthcare team and your doctor about specific strategies for you, especially if there's any like insulin injections or blood sugar lowering medications involved. But when you're thinking about snacks and ways to like keep a steadier blood sugar level throughout the whole holiday, check in with the host if you're not hosting and see what snacks, if any, that they're planning to serve before dinner, just in case, like you mentioned, things take a little longer than expected. This can help you plan accordingly, but also is a great opportunity for you to offer to bring something that you know will help keep your blood sugar levels more stable, whether that's like a veggie crudité or like a fiber-packed dip like a hummus with some whole grain crackers. Yeah, lots of great options.
Now, for that host, what kind of recommendations do you have for, maybe this is more on the social side of things, but talking to their guests, maybe that person they know has a blood sugar issue, and coordinating with them to make sure that, you know, at least 80% of the meal is going to be friendly to everybody?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think transparency and just communicating with each other, that's key, right? Because like I said, diabetes and any like blood sugar related illness is really individual. So if you're hosting and you know someone has special considerations, whether it's diabetes or even like a food allergy, just ask, how can I best make this enjoyable for you too? Is there anything that I should consider? When we think about diabetes, there's two main things to consider, two main nutrients to consider. So carbohydrates, particularly simple carbohydrates. So those are things that burn up more quickly, like your added sugars, and also saturated fats. So an easy way to limit added sugars is just by reducing the amount of sweetener or sugar that's added to foods, particularly dessert, or considering what toppings am I adding to things like sweet potatoes that are already naturally quite sweet, and opting for things like fruit that are naturally sweet that can meet that craving in a way that better aligns with their goals and has some fiber. And for saturated fat, it's best to just enjoy smaller portions of like the creamy or cheesy foods or things like gravy. And also if you're open to it, opting for reduced or like non-fat dairy and cheese options for lowering the saturated fat a bit.
You said a couple magic words that I keyed in on there. Sweet potatoes, Jessica, we also call them yams sometimes. I love them. I don't like when people put, you know, the marshmallows and sweet stuff. I like them as a savory food. And I've heard anyway, and correct me if I'm wrong, that compared to potatoes, they can be a little better on glycemic indexes and things like that. Is a sweet potato a good strategy for cooking for the holidays with blood sugar in mind?
I think a sweet potato can be a great option for people if they enjoy it and are, you know, it's a classic for a reason, right? If they're delicious. And like I said, they are sweet naturally. Mm-hmm. That's obviously the natural sugars in the potato itself. But they also contain a lot of fiber. They contain a lot of vitamins, beta carotene being one. But yeah, they're a great wholesome option. And again, just being mindful of the toppings, I think that any food that has fiber, any of like the vegetables, even winter squash, is great for people who have diabetes, who are looking for something that's digested a little more slowly.
And preparation method for the sweet potatoes, I peel them, dice them, toss them in some oil and spices and roast them a little over 400 till they're starting to crystallize or a little bit, or caramelize. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. Do you have a favorite way to prepare and or eat sweet potatoes, Jessica?
Yeah, I'll share one from our recent spotlight that's newer to me, but totally delicious. So we interviewed Anthony Anderson, who's a celebrity who manages diabetes, and he shared his sweet potato home fries with cranberry and hazelnut crumble. Absolutely delicious, like all the Thanksgiving flavors in one bite. And kind of similar to what you said, they're cubed, they're sauteed up, so they're a little bit browned, they're delicious.
Jessica Ball is with us, registered dietitian and nutrition editor for Eating Well. We're talking about diabetes-friendly holiday cooking and meal planning, and not just sweet potatoes. Sorry about that detour. I love sweet potatoes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your life, your holiday planning over the next handful of days? Join in now at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your strategies, or your questions for Jessica. That's 800-642-1234. All right, let's talk about desserts. We've got a recipe that we'll talk about in just a minute. But in general, I mean, obviously, we think of desserts as super sweet and sugary. Are there approaches to dessert that can be a little more diabetic friendly?
Yeah, so there are a few things that I look for in a really great holiday dessert, whether or not you have diabetes. And one of those would be make ahead. So we took some care to have, I think the recipe that we shared with you, but a lot of recipes in our spotlight have the ability to be made in advance to save you some time and precious oven space on the day of. Just give you a little flexibility. But all of our recipes, including the desserts, were designed with our diabetes-friendly nutrition parameters. So we're obviously a nutrition wellness brand. We have a bunch of different nutrition parameters. And for diabetes, this means recipes are mindful of carbohydrates and low in added sugars. They limit saturated fat and sodium. And they rely on things like fruits, nuts, and seeds or nut butters and spices for something that's really delicious, but can help align with people's goals who have diabetes. And, you know, with options like our cranberry crumble bars or our peppermint chocolate tart, like what more can I say? They are delicious.
And that's one of the ones you shared with us. That's the one you shared with us, the peppermint chocolate tart. We've got that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ends up being lower than we might think in sugar. Can you talk us through that recipe a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So tarts are obviously like beautiful, eye-catching. The little peppermint candy crumble on top is like really show-stopping. I think it would be also great for Christmas as well as Thanksgiving or whatever holidays that you celebrate this season. But it's super simple. You make a simple crust. We include whole wheat flour in the crust and some cinnamon for a little fiber and some anti-inflammatory benefits. You bake that alone, and then you make the tart filling, which includes, you know, dark chocolate. Chocolate is another powerful anti-inflammatory, actually. Just we opt for dark chocolate because it's lower in the added sugars, and peppermint extract for some delicious flavor. It's sweetened with things like honey, which we still consider a source of added sugar, but it is more flavorful, and is still low in added sugar compared to standard desserts. So once the crust is cooled, you swirl together the filling, add it, let it set, and then sprinkle on top with some crushed peppermint candies if you desire. It's really delicious.
We're talking to Jessica Bell, nutrition editor at Eating Well. You can find lots more dessert-related diabetic-friendly recipes there. Talking about holiday cooking for people with diabetes, whether you're the host or the guest, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Whether it's you or a loved one, what role does diabetes play in your holiday season? Are you cooking for someone with diabetes? Maybe you have it yourself. Have you consulted with a healthcare professional on trying to come up with good holiday meals that work well from a health standpoint as well? Have you found alternatives to some of the Thanksgiving favorites? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Jessica Ball, registered dietitian and nutrition editor for Eating Well. She's with us today to help us with our holiday cooking for people who have diabetes, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is diabetes part of your holiday meal planning? If you have it yourself, or if you're cooking for those who do, love to hear your workarounds, your substitutions. Maybe you found something even better than the original, or if you have questions for our guest, you need some advice and or inspiration, You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jessica, I want to dig further into a point you made earlier. You know, this is kind of general advice. Everybody's diabetes experience may be different. There's type 1. There's type 2. Can you talk about all the different things people might have to factor in and maybe even think about talking to a healthcare provider about?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to briefly touch on for people who aren't as familiar, type 1 diabetes is a type of where your body does not produce insulin. Type 2 is where your body becomes less sensitive to insulin over time. And so people with type 2 diabetes might be able to intake insulin in another way to help manage their blood sugar levels, whereas people with type 1 diabetes might need to find alternate strategies or require insulin. And insulin is kind of like a lock and key. It allows blood sugar, so blood glucose, into your cells. It's how our cells get energy to do all the things that they do for us. And so I think some of the common symptoms can really vary, and there might be no symptoms related to things like pre-diabetes, which is when your blood sugar levels are more elevated, but not quite elevated enough to classify as diabetes. So if you're at all curious, talk to your healthcare provider. They can do a test called HbA1c. It's a hemoglobin A1c. That's like a 90-day average of your blood sugar levels to determine where you are and help determine a healthy range for you. But I can't stress enough, like, everyone is different. Everyone's diabetes is different. Definitely talk to your healthcare professional, like a doctor.
Now, a strategy I have after a big holiday meal and not related to diabetes at all is, gosh, I'm really full. Hey, everybody, let's go for a walk. And you write, and you gave us some notes, exercise actually can play a big role in helping get through that holiday. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of my favorite fun facts, but we have covered some research studies about how even just walking for a few minutes, like anywhere from 2 minutes to 5 or 10 minutes, can almost immediately lower your blood sugar levels. So yeah, I think over the holidays, one great strategy is to find some movement every day. And this doesn't have to be complicated and it doesn't have to be long, but it could be something like a morning walk to, you know, get out, have some personal time before the madness of the day, or maybe something more organized like a family game or a local event like a turkey trot if you're feeling up to something like that. But I would also remind listeners that movement can compound throughout the day. So let's say after each meal, you go for a 5-minute walk, that's 15 minutes of movement at the end of the day that you might not have had otherwise. And it will definitely help impact healthy blood sugar levels.
Well, I think our caller Sandy in Madison has some thoughts on exercise. Sandy, hi.
Hi. Actually, she kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that for me, what really works is to just take a walk. And that would be before the meal, after the meal, or both. And that really seems to help.
And do you, for a holiday, Sandy, do you organize this as a group and or family activity, or do you just take off on your own for a bit?
Well, if somebody wants to go with me, that's fine. Otherwise, I just take my dog and go.
Excellent. Sandy, thank you so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Before and after the meal, she says, Jessica, she goes for that walk with dog and maybe with some of her dining companions.
Yeah, I love that. Like, it doesn't have to be complicated, right? It can be as simple as lacing up your shoes and just getting out the door for a few minutes.
Thanks again for sharing that call, Sandy, at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Jessica Ball is with us, nutrition editor for Eating Well. We're talking about holiday or diabetes-friendly holiday meal planning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jessica, you have some thoughts on, it's Thanksgiving coming up, on gratitude as we think about the food we eat and the holiday. Could you share some of your thoughts with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for a lot of people, the holidays feel like a pretty natural time to, you know, to reflect on the previous year. And I think gratitude falls into that. So even though it's a little easier said than done, it's important to take some time, I think, to think about what you're grateful for, whether things feel like they're going really well, or maybe they feel like they aren't. And it might do more than benefit just your perspective alone. So we have found some research as well that shows practicing gratitude might benefit your physical health as well. It can help reduce your stress levels, help lower blood pressure, and actually help lower blood sugar levels. It can also help increase serotonin and dopamine. These are like the happy hormones and promote overall well-being for your mental and physical health.
Now, for some families, alcohol might be part of the get-together. I know for some people with diabetes, that's probably just off the table. For those who can drink, though, what are some things they could do to make it a little more diabetes-friendly?
Yeah, for sure. Like you mentioned, it's a little complicated, alcohol and diabetes. So this is another, I feel like a broken record, but talk to your healthcare team about strategies that are good for you personally. But the general guidelines are no more than one drink a day for females and no more than two drink a day for males. So this, a standard drink is around 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of a distilled spirit like vodka or rum. So some ways to make that a little bit more diabetes friendly are to always consume alcohol with food and never drink on an empty stomach if you can avoid it, or when your blood glucose levels are low. So don't skip a meal if you know that you're going to be at an event where there might be some alcohol involved. And also for if you are consuming a drink, try and avoid drinks that are lower in or that are higher in alcohol content. So choose ones that are lower in alcohol content and choose mixers that are lower in added sugar. So like seltzers or club sodas or 100% fruit juice that has no added sugar. Even diet soda might be a better option for your diabetes than a traditional soda, which is high in added sugar.
Now, Jessica, you mentioned earlier the actor Anthony Anderson. He collaborated with you at Eating Well on this on the diabetes-friendly holiday theme. And a part of the goal there is, I think, just to have more people talking about diabetes and being aware of it. How important a part of the story is that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we really loved working with Anthony. And one of the things that we loved about working with him is how real and forthcoming he was about living his life to the fullest, even with diabetes. And part of that is understanding that all foods can be part of a healthy diet. And you don't need to cut out the things that you love, either during the holidays or anytime when you're diagnosed with diabetes. So that's the message that we convey to our readers at Eating Well each and every day. So it was great to hear that he was aligned with that. And it was really nice to have the opportunity to sit down with him. And actually, like I kind of alluded to earlier, we were able to publish a few of his personal recipes on our website. So you'll have to go to eatingwell.com to check those out. But yeah, really great that there are ways to enjoy yourself and be healthy when you have diabetes.
You mentioned the sweet potato fries recipes. What are some of the other things we'll find? You mentioned also a couple of desserts. What are some of the other holiday recipes you're sharing on the diabetes theme?
Oh, there's so many, but I'll give you some of the highlights. The first that I am looking forward to making this year, our prosciutto wrapped pineapple bites. Ooh. So this is like a little sweet and salty one bite appetizers. They're on a little toothpick, so perfect for like an appetizer or potluck spread. And this is where I mentioned like that leaning into the natural sources of sweetness, like fruits, can be just as satisfying. And this is a great example. We also have some 3-ingredient cranberry and brie bites that are baked in little like pre-made pie crust cups that are super delicious and crowd pleasing. We have a roasted beet salad for something more like a main. We already talked about our peppermint chocolate tart, but the last dessert that I'll call out that I think is really fun are our apple pie in an apple. So the crust, quote unquote, of the pie is like the apple itself. And then there's a little bit of pie crust on top. They're visually really great and they are lower in added sugar while still feeling really festive and classic.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jessica, taking it back to the beginning, I think part of your hope here is that we don't add a lot of stress with our diabetes-friendly holiday cooking. Holidays can be stressful enough on their own. With a little advanced planning, though, it sounds like we can have things go pretty smoothly.
Yeah, definitely. I think planning is one key part of it, like checking in with people who are hosting, seeing if they can help accommodate with your needs if you have diabetes, or planning for the foods that you're preparing to make them in a way that's inherently more diabetes friendly. But I also think that strategies in the moment can be really helpful too, right? Because nothing goes according to plan, you know, least of all at the holidays. So things like I mentioned, that plate method where half your plate is vegetables, a quarter is proteins, and a quarter is carbs. It just helps you have a balanced meal just with a quick glance. No one even needs to know that you're thinking about it that way, but it can help you have a meal that's balanced and actually energizing and aligned with your goals.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Ball is a registered dietitian and the nutrition editor for Eating Well. She's with us today to share advice and recipes for holiday cooking for loved ones with diabetes on this edition of Food Friday. Find one of those desserts we talked about over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, everybody sleeps, but why? Look at the latest science and research into the mysteries of human sleep, why we do it in the first place, and what is going on in our brains when we are asleep. Join that conversation Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A couple days ago, we talked about the magic of making musical compilations, mixtapes, mix CDs, online playlists, that sort of thing. Our guests shared great advice. You called in with your stories, and we heard a few more after the show. Jana says, I make a playlist for my birthday each year. It's the songs I learned that year or reconnected with. Although I spam my friends and family with it, it's primarily for me, so I can feel happy on my birthday. Michelle in Janesville says her cousin made her a mixtape in the 1980s that held up so well she passed it along to her son. And her own Sarah Hopeful says, I used to torture my family with mixed CDs on family car trips. Really odd mix of musicals, movie scores, Muppet Treasure Island. It was a beauty. Keep sharing your playlist and mixtape stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.